Welcome to another episode of the Innovativeness Imperative Podcast, where my guest and I will explore innovativeness, which is the quality that results from the combined enhancement of customer experience and employee experience to consistently generate new ideas, products, and services in a business. And is required in a business, because if you're not innovating, you're dying. All right, welcome to another episode of the Innovativeness Imperative. This is the podcast where we explore innovativeness, which is the quality that results from the combined enhancements of customer experience and employee experience to consistently generate new ideas, products, and services in a business. And it's required in a business because if you're not innovating, you are dying. I'm your host, Malcolm Tyson. And I have with me today an extraordinary individual. He is the founder and principal consultant of Ethos Consultancy, LLC, which focuses on supporting high growth companies in manufacturing and technology. His focus is on process improvement, transitioning companies from drain to gain enhanced with culture development for increased operational visibility and collaborative execution. Prior to that, he was a vice president at Technology Solution Services, where he spent some time leading a Mexico business unit and international team responsible for multiple Fortune 500 projects and generating 40% of the company's overall revenue. He received his bachelor's in business administration and master's in organizational development from Pepperdine University, and the father of twin girls. That's amazing. And curious about everything space related. We have that in common. I worked at NASA for quite a bit, and I love everything space, Star Wars, all of it. I love all of it. So welcome, Humberto Garcia. Thanks for joining me today.
Appreciate it. Thank you for the warm welcome, Malcolm. Happy to be here and excited for the conversation. Yes. Love space because it gets you thinking about where this small makes you humble, and the possibilities are endless when you really put your mind to it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I don't think I did you justice in sort of introducing you. So just give the listeners a bit about yourself professionally, personally, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. So like you mentioned in the introduction, I spent most of my career working in the manufacturing industry down in Mexico and leading international teams. So I got to see a lot of the culture in Mexico of the Latin American values and United States. I grew up here, born and raised here. So that bridge and that gap between both societies, it was really enlightening understanding how US and corporate business here in the United States views Latin America and also uses the workforce and the creativity and a lot of the intelligence and knowledge that exists down there. Yeah. But it's two different cultures, so you have to work with those synergies and those roadblocks. And in my professional positions out there, I really started at the floor level and worked my way up into the higher ranks. So I got an understanding of what it looked like from the corporate strategy execution and how that actually translated into practical implementation. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely challenging, frustrating, stressful, high pressure at times. But when you look, at least when I look back on the experience, it was really fulfilling and seeing that. So I focused on process improvement inside of my consultancy. And I like process improvement because it requires continuous innovation, looking at your environment, responding to your environment, adapting with the needs of your customers and clients, but also adapting with the needs of your people, the people you're employing, you're hiring, strategically placing them in key positions to be leaders, whether that is through authority, through title, but also understanding leaders exist in your company that are influencers and they don't have that title and that authority. And they're equally important as the people that are on the org chart.
Yeah.
Personally, I love the human behavior side of business. And for me, I got into organizational development for my master's, taking the last course in college, which was OD related. And I left that course, graduated college, but was continuously hungry. It was the only course that really stood out to me. And I did business administration.
Yeah.
So pretty dry, pretty straightforward there. And I didn't want to go into an MBA, but I didn't know what I wanted. I did know what I wanted to go to. And that was elaborating and learning more about OD. And
yeah,
fell in love with it. And personally, it really helped me out a lot. Those 2 years in my master's program felt like therapy, because it really is a lot of personal work. If you can't manage yourself, how are you going to manage somebody else, let alone organizations and teams, and especially under pressure and in high stress situations? Then also equally, it taught me a lot about myself, really acceptance for what my passions are, what my values are, really getting to understand what my superpower is, and really being transparent and open about that, not kind of sitting in the back hiding. It's just kind of accepting who you are. Not everyone's going to like you. Perfectly fine, and enjoy the journey and be present for it. So
that's awesome. And it just dawned on me, like, with your background, so obviously there's the cultural differences between how you learn things in a school in America, in North America, and then in Mexico. Could you just talk to me just briefly about some of the differences that you see, and how you learned about the business and what you actually saw in those environments in Mexico?
So I think when it's kind of in a school based, the models look similar. It is lecture, it is studying, reading, coursework, projects, where I think kind of some of the shift is, it's US is very individualistic by nature, the culture, versus Latin countries in Mexico, they're very collectivistic. They look for a family unit. It's about the whole, the greater of the whole, the organization. And in the US, it's singular. But at some point, you do need to transition and learn how to engage and work with others and trust others, ultimately, and have transparent communication in advance. So I think those were the very distinct aspects of the culture. But what helped me is kind of understanding what is the foundation. At the end of the day, we're all humans, we're all people, we're working for personal gain, and we're also working for personal fulfillment as well. And if you're supporting other people, I think that was very key for me learning that at the end of the day, we're doing this to provide something better for ourselves and for our loved ones. And really kind of understanding that and voicing that with the culture down there, I think it helped me get a lot of acceptance and validation, because I was born and raised in the US, but I have Latin parents. So be in both worlds, but also the constant battle of my parents were born and raised in another country. So them also wanting to instill those values and that upbringing in us, but also realizing that there's some assimilation happening for them immigrating into the United States. So I think that was a constant battle. I'm first generation born in the United States. So for me, I'm American by birth, but I'm Latin American by blood, and the values, really having commonality, that's what really helped bridge that gap when I went to go work in Mexico.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. And so you bring up a great point of, and that's something I did not know, just the emphasis on sort of the family, the collective unit. Because in my business, what I try to do is create that or reveal it in businesses, right? That it's really the power of the collective unit, where you may have, well, from my studies, you have an entrepreneurial system going on, and then you have sort of this administrative system going on. And that healthy tension between them, that's where innovation lies, right? That's where you have an entrepreneurial free spirit person, and then you have your budget person telling them, kind of reeling them back in. But by them working together, you can create something phenomenal. Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button now, where you listen to your favorite podcasts. The Innovativeness Imperative is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show. And so have you seen that in your experience, where compared to the, as you said, the individualistic approach, have you seen where the collective is more innovative than, say, the individualistic approach, or have you seen any difference at all in those?
I have. I think a key point to remember is that there is individualistic, and in organizations, small and large, and as they get bigger, there are individual players, and there has to be. The leaders at the higher level, the exec level, the senior directors, mm-hmm. they have to have a sense of autonomy in making those decisions too and implementing the vision.
Yeah.
And I think it's key that multiple minds together, yes, it's very needed, it's very creative, and it helps the process. And like you said, I think you said it great, it's healthy tension. Mm-hmm. Healthy conflict can and should and will exist in organizations. And it's that debate of mind and perspective of thought that really makes the strategy and the intent of the strategy and how it's rolled out really more robust. And for me, I have seen the individual and CEOs, perfect individuals in companies that run and that high level vision. They're the dreamers. But like you said, you have the people that need to reel it in where it's, you have the people that execute the vision, but then what happens when you give it to the people that are physically responsible for the implementation? It looks very different. You take those abstract ideas that do have some tangibility around it, mm-hmm. but now you have to make it into your daily practice and policy.
Yeah.
And when you roll that down, I think that's where the teams are really effective too.
Yeah.
Not one person can shoulder the whole company. And when you accept that, that means you're transferring trust, you're transferring accountability, and you're transferring ownership of key processes in your operations to be carried out by the people who are the experts at that mid and lower level of the organization. And lower, not in the sense of floor workers, but the people that are doing the day-to-day activities so they can accomplish that long-term strategic vision. Mm-hmm. So it's very key that you work that into the culture. If you can't debate over a challenge, then how do you question whether the decision I'm going to implement, am I wrong? Mm-hmm. And if you're just asking yourself, how am I right? Well, now you're creating tunnel vision and you're going to make some bad choices and mistakes that could be very detrimental to your organization.
Yeah, that's man, that's so good. The I like to say that the leader of an organization really set the boundaries of how far that entrepreneur, those people with the entrepreneurial spirit and entrepreneurial system, how far they can go. And also set the boundaries for how the people that are the administrative type folks, how the leader kind of keeps a leash on them, right? It keeps a leash on it, puts a boundary around the culture. And if that leader, I had an experience once where the leader didn't really understand their impact or the fact that they were creating those boundaries around both systems, right? So instead of creating a fence around this, you know, parameters for healthy tension, it was just a free for all. It was just a free for all, and that person didn't know that they were impacting, you know, how things were happening every day. And it's strange. It came about because I asked him to just talk to some of his people, some of his direct reports, and he said, he sensed it. He said, everybody gave him the answer he wanted to hear. And it was, as you said, there was no honesty. There was no, and meanwhile, everything that's happening, all the sort of the things to get things done, the activities to get things done, they were happening without his knowledge. They were getting done, right? Things were getting done. People were coming up with ideas, but I don't know if they were afraid of him or I think they were just uncomfortable with him because he was a super introvert, very visionary guy, but he not really a great communicator.
And those dynamics were a little, wouldn't say misaligned, but you could feel, I guess, the awkwardness of the individual who is the high up, and everybody looks up to the leaders in organizations they behave this way, they communicate this way, they're open to constructive criticism this way. Mm-hmm. And well, what do they look like behind closed doors? And the general masses in organization, they don't see that. That's where the exec team comes in. But like you said, if there's that tension and there's that bad role modeling and behavior and there's no guardrails on it, well, the exec teams, they bring that right out into the general environment and the way they interact with their direct reports as well. It's just the trickle effect. So it is interesting when you say that. It's just, and sometimes they're not aware of it, which is unless someone calls them out. And like you said, if it's just yes men around you and surround, it's just a sound, it's just an echo chamber.
Yeah.
You might as well be in there alone because you're not getting, like you said, the innovativeness and the collective challenging, and the creativeness of everybody having some input. And having input doesn't mean you need to be right or wrong. Mm-hmm. It means you need to be listened to.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you have to feel that you're able to voice that into the general conversation and have those open conversations. And it is an interesting dynamic that happens in those senior leadership teams, especially at big corporations. You think they have everything disciplined, that they grew that big because they are at the top of their game. But if you're invited behind the curtain, which the general public doesn't, unless you become an employee and you work your way up, then you start to see the dysfunction, the disorder, the siloed operations.
Yeah.
These are my resources, not your resources. We need a pseudo play together, but we're not going to play together. And it's the same company, right? Everybody's supposed to work towards the same bottom line, but you know, everyone has their metrics and they got to hit their numbers in their own way too.
So that brings up, another great point, and I want you to kind of elaborate on. In your company, you talk about process improvement. How do you address that? Because I'm looking at it from the perspective of creating an innovative culture, which they're in the same family, right? Continuous improvement or business process improvement, it's in the same family. It's on the sort of less disruptive end of the spectrum. But how would you address that if you're seeing that, to create a more innovative culture, or at least a culture that can, you know, allow some incremental improvements?
So when I'm talking about process improvement, I'm really focusing on the workflow, the way the value creation is, the whole value chain creation in an organization from a workflow standpoint. What are your processes? Where are the decisions being made in each step of the process? Mm-hmm. What does the linear process look like at a manufacturing company? And what decisions happen in that linear process that sends that particular product to another area that are the satellite operations that are supporting. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about culture and how do you make it innovative, I like bringing in the culture piece to it, because you could draw everything out. You map it out, decision trees, this happens, goes here. Here's the report that we're taking. Here's how we're in line with our certifications. Here's how we're archiving metrics, data, quality, whatnot. But there's a person interacting with that system. There's a person interacting with that process.
Enjoying the show? We'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or simply share the show with a friend or colleague that may enjoy this new community or want to learn how to spark their innovativeness. That would help us out too. Now back to the show.
And is that the right person? And as that person in that process and leading those teams, how are they also contributing to the conversation to implement and execute on the strategy that's being done from the top? Do the stakeholders have a voice in the conversation when some decisions are being made 2-3 levels above them? And for me, I think that's very key. You create a ripple effect when you're making investments in technology, when you're taking resources from one department to compensate in other departments, or some departments are subsidizing the cost of another department.
Yeah.
Well, do the people on the floor have an understanding of how those cost works, how their input and output is contributing to that top and bottom line revenue, and then ultimately the net profit you're walking away with? And when you don't introduce them into the conversations, well, you're limiting the innovativeness of that culture, because they have great ideas, they have great input, and they have real-time data, real-time information. And yes, it's subjective because it's in their limited scope. But that's the whole point of having the conversation, but directly tying that back to what is the objective? What is the objective goals of the operation? And how does that line up with the strategy? And are those creating the value that we're maximizing as a company? And are they moving us in the right direction to serve our client needs? And I think where the innovativeness comes in too, is when you have that open, transparent conversation across multiple levels of your company, you really start to think about how are you going to be adapting to change. You need to be resilient to a lot of the volatility that could be potentially happening. And then you also have to carry those conversations out with the clients you have under contract or your strategic partnerships as well. Because they are a key component of your overall network, but they may not operate in your building, but they are influencing what you're doing as well. And those should be considered.
Yeah. I mean, they're definitely a part of your ecosystem, right? And so if your culture is one way, and I mean, I've seen this as well, where if you don't have a culture that doesn't have the candor, doesn't have the accountability, it's going to show up in your customer interactions, right? And not even just your customer, your vendors, right? That your suppliers, you're going to see that. You're going to have mistrust. You're going to have miscommunication. You're going to have these things because that's what your culture is, right? And whether, you know, again, goes back to the leader. Leader has to really be able to keep a finger on what that culture is. And it's unfortunate. Some leaders don't. Right. They just, you know, miss the ball with handling the cultures. And so that brings me to another question, because you brought up the point of, you know, individuals having that, it being a bit subjective as you work through processes and trying to get that to that improvement. How do you protect that culture? How do you in your role as a, say, a third party coming in and looking at and trying to work through process improvement, how do you protect that culture so that it can continue to thrive once you leave? Because that's, as a consultant, that's the greatest thing that we have to deal with. Once we leave, once we're not talking to them, once we're not interfacing with them, things just go down the toilet. How do you deal with that? How do you protect that culture and some of the things that you do in your business?
I think one of the best frames of reference I was taught was, as a consultant, and especially in OD, you're not there to be an extra pair of hands, which is key. And if that's the case and have to have the conversation feels, then you don't have any purpose or value to serve. You're just an extra pair of hands, something that they can hand the list off to, make sure you check those boxes, come back, I'll give you the next list.
Yeah.
Versus coming in a position where you want to possess and contain and deliver transferable knowledge to your client. And that transferable knowledge, and the way I look at it, is everything you say and do is an intervention. And when you start to think about it from those aspects, when you're intervening, you're disrupting. Yeah. So having those conversations up front of what the intent of any of these change management initiatives you might do or new process improvements, it's really getting down to that the key area that's really going to make it successful long-term is really making sure that the people are ready for that challenge of that change, that they know what the focus is going to be, and that it's just not lip service when it's sponsored by the executive team, that they're wholly committed because they are a critical component of any change or any intervention you're going to make into a process. If they don't sign off on it, it's bound to derail whether they hired you or not and you complete your engagement. Like you said, once you leave, it goes off the rails and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so I think kind of really talking about the reality of what change is, we are changing a process, but ultimately we're trying to change the behavior of the people in those processes. And that's very difficult. We like predictability. We like to know what's coming next. We don't like disruption. Mm-hmm. And the way the brain works, it latches onto what's comfortable.
Yeah.
So really addressing that and trying to kind of prime them in the conversation of why are we doing this? Who are we doing it for? And are those people contributing in their opinion and direction and communication? And if not, we need to identify them and introduce them and bring them into these conversations. Because ultimately, it's easy to say we're going to change it, but then the change is not happening to you directly.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very key point. It really is about that conversation. And I keep always going back in operations, really about the culture you want to build. And how do you protect the culture? Well, as a third party coming in, if you don't understand what the culture is, well, you need to have that conversation with the leaders too. How do they see their culture? What are their company mission? What's the vision? What are some strong values that at the base level, everybody could identify with? And ultimately, people come to work for organizations because they fall in love with the message, the people. Mm-hmm. They have some sense of an emotional connection that when they read that job description or they see those ads or they just see this company and walk into the place, they could feel the energy that brings them in the door, that gets them in the seat. But once they're in the seat and they're in the building and they have that official title and they're now inside your organization, well, do those public and outward values that drew them in, do those really exist there? And as leaders, you really need to think about that dynamic. How do you put the company values into daily practice and policy and reinforce that? And that also comes to bringing people along for the journey, the leaders that are in the teams. they also have to believe in what the company mission is and the company values, and they have to reflect those as well. Mm-hmm. A disengaged employee is not committed to the company value, and they will deliver bad value to your customers. Mm-hmm. That's who it transfers over to.
Yeah.
So for me, it's really having that conversation up front and then planning it out strategically, implementing mm-hmm. that change, having metrics that you can measure what you're doing. If you're going to change processes, what are some realistic measurements that are going to let you know whether those changes are having an effect? And also realizing once you intervene, there is going to be a decrease in some of the performance productivity because they're getting used to it.
Right.
And you need to be comfortable with that.
Yeah.
But it's not sustained deficiency. It's just a momentary lapse. It's you learn a new skill. You're not great at it right away. Exactly. You got to get the reps in and get better at it. And I think that's a key thing that you really got to understand when you're doing these interventions at companies, whether it's process improvement, acquisitions, new technologies, new infrastructure, new systems. There has to be that understanding that it's going to be a little uncomfortable at first. It's not going to look like what you wanted to on paper. But if you keep measuring it and keep feeding that information back to the relevant parties and keep continuously engaged with them, it gets better and it sticks.
Enjoying what you're hearing? We'd love to hear how the innovativeness imperative is impacting the way you do business. Keep listening to hear how you can leave us a message that we may use or respond to on an episode. Also, subscribe where you listen to your favorite podcast so you don't miss an episode. Now back to the show. Yeah. No, that's really good. I think one of the things that you said that really resonated with me is that it's really difficult to change a person's mind, right? Without giving them a reason why. You're the father of twin girls. How old are they?
They're 5 years old.
Okay. So, you know, trying to change their minds about something that they're set on, that is, it's virtually impossible. You have to pull your dad cards. Like you're doing this because I said to do it, not because, mm-hmm. you know, not because I'm really convincing you to do it. Right. And so, it is a challenge, but I think you hit it right on the head. It's really about getting them engaged, helping them understand why they're doing it. And then giving them what I found, and you probably do this too. Most people, even though they're in a department or a group, what's in it for them? Like, what's in it for them? Mm-hmm. You know? And so addressing that at the jump, at the beginning, right? This is going to be able to allow you to do this more efficiently or whatever the case may be. And then the other thing that I thought was really important that you said is socializing the fact that there is going to be a dip in performance as you go through this learning curve. Right. As you go through this learning curve, there is going to be a dip in performance. But if you follow the improvement process, the way you outlined it, the way you spelled it out, it's going to bounce back and it's going to be bounced back even better. Right. And mm-hmm. I think that is I've seen consultants that they miss that point. Right. And so they're expecting it to. Soon we're going live with this new process, you know, December 1st, it's going to be, you know, 110%, right? We're going to show 100% growth and efficiency. And it doesn't. It starts at, 20-30% as people are trying to figure it out and make sure, you know, they work all the kinks out. You know, the communication flow is in the appropriate place. But, you know, I think that's so important. You know, as a consultant going in and trying to protect their culture, because I think if you don't, you lose credibility, right? And then your culture starts to break down because what you're trying to implement is not working. So
exactly. And I think that point you're making as well is really important too, that you're going to have a dip. And the trap there is that you're going to be tempted to go back to what you were before you try to mm-hmm. put this implementation in place, which means you got to break down all the resources. You made investments in infrastructure, if you changed your manufacturing lines, if you bought new things, well, what happens to those? They get put to the side, they get written off. And then at that point, it's just, you have a semi-broken and old system again, and you just reinforce the thought that change is bad. We need to stay in our lane, stay what we know with, and keep working at it. We're still delivering product, but for me, I heard a great saying was, just because it's not defective doesn't mean it's effective. And that's such a key point in processes. What are the shortcuts people created to get to the finish line quicker that is not the documented process? And if you're not aware of that, you start to wonder, well, why did it end up here in this manner? And unless you really look at your process to do those improvements and work backwards with the people that are responsible for it and understand the routes that they go, you may never identify that. And that limits visibility and leadership decisions too. And could create big problems for you down the road.
So that's a great segue into to my next question. We talked about some of the challenges that you may see as far as implementation with a process, a new process. And what are some of the challenges you're seeing or challenges that you see in your business in the near future?
I think it's a disruption, one from the pandemic, and not so much the pandemic itself. The disruptions it's creating is obvious. I think of mental health and how that's going to affect company cultures and going virtual and then back and forth of hybrid, but we keep going in these cycles, unfortunately, where we do have more spread of COVID. And what's that going to do mentally? How's that going to impact newer generations of workers that are coming in? How are they going to be more efficient? Because they're going to learn how to get better and more efficient working virtually. Technology is being distributed. But when they start to come back in, like manufacturing companies, they don't have the luxury of that. You manufacture, you need someone on the floor. You need those engineering teams potentially there 100% or not, depending how technical and high technology is involved. But the people that are there, I think it's a balance of trying to figure out what's equitable in their minds versus the people that are at home. They get to not commute. They don't have to deal with some of the other things, the exposure of risk. How does a company communicate that they value them? How do they communicate that they understand and acknowledge what it means to come into work in this time? But once the pandemic passes, to not going back to the old culture that reinforced the toxic environment, because manufacturing has a very bad phenomenon of, in Mexico, we call it musical chairs. Employees knew you show up at one facility for 3 months, you maximize your benefits because the pay structure is a little different down there. There's a lot of incentives that are built into the hourly wage that is the company responsibility. Where here you see it the other way, there might be some government support within some of that. And they knew that on day 91, let's go to the next factory. And that is just a high cost of turnover and retraining and repurposing work to for those seasonal dips and highs. So in the US too, there is toxic environments in manufacturing because manufacturing requires feeding the beast. When you manufacture, it's about volume. Volume and low margin. So if you're not producing volume, you're potentially going to go out of business. So I think that's a big challenge there. It's really, how do you connect better with a workforce that the processes may not be challenging? They could get highly repetitive and the boredom, and making sure that the turnover isn't high. And I think it's really investing in the culture, making sure you're providing opportunities for growth in there, and that you're consistently having some good key level strategic conversations with the workforce as well, letting them know that you acknowledge their contribution, you understand that they're providing value for you, and treating them right at the end of the day. The high pressure and high volume, it's not going away. I think for me, the key is really doubling down on the people, the relationship executive and management and upper management has with the people at the middle and at the bottom that are the ones doing a lot of the heavy lifting and making that product or that service happen. That's very key to make sure you're connected with them and giving high engagement in the environment that exists.
No, your point about the effect of the pandemic on that interrelation with employees, whether they're in the office or in the factory or out of the factory, it still has to happen. And I just think of your scenario that you gave me about, you know, the sort of rotation among the workers. And I just think, man, just every time someone leaves a company, leaves a factory, goes to another, they're taking their innovativeness with them, right? They're taking their strategic thinking or even part of the culture with them, right? And that's, man, I could just imagine that would be a huge challenge. You're listening to the Innovativeness Imperative Podcast, the show that brings you global conversations with business leaders like you to spark your innovativeness, inspire you on your entrepreneurial journey, and help sharpen your leadership skills. With your host, Dr. Malcolm Tyson, award-winning business leader, entrepreneur, and innovative culture advocate. Now back to the show. Right there. I had I used to work with a gentleman. He owned a number of fast food restaurants, and he was sort of dealing with the same thing, right? But it wasn't like the employees just were deciding at, you know, because of the state pay structure, they were deciding to leave. It just, you know, he had summer employees, their high schoolers come in, they just want to work for the summer and they can't work during the school year. And I was like, well, he was like, you know, that's a part of our business. We expect high turnover. I was like, really? Like, how much do you pay to get them trained up? And he was like, it's kind of minimal. But when you look at it on his profit and loss statement, it's a huge number. It's a huge number. You're getting these students, you're just getting a lot of turnover. And I was like, well, every time they leave and you have to spend money to train them, why don't you invest a little bit more in your culture so that they want to stay? And so instead of, you know, you're just hiring them and they leave, make them seasonal workers where they can come back, right? When they come back, they don't have to be trained up and all, you have to go through stuff back over again. And so it was one of the things, you know, just to help them, you know, I guess that was an improvement that we were able to implement, but it just amazes me at some of these companies, they're okay with the level of turnover. Right. And I just, I don't know. It just doesn't sit with me. Right. If you have a high turnover, that means there's something else going on. To me, that's a symptom, right, of something else going on, right, within their culture. And, you know, what does that mean to your customers? How is that affecting your customers if you constantly have turnover? It may not be a big deal, but I think there's definitely value in creating an environment where employees want to stay, whether it be fast food, manufacturing, whatever the case may be, where they want to stay and where they're proud to say, I work there.
Yeah, that's very key. And I think it's an important point you're making. And me, I'm thinking in my head that certain industries, certain companies, their models, not the business model of how they're going to adapt and stay competitive and offer new service or new product, but the nature of it might not change.
Yeah.
And understanding that it might not change, well, how do you bring something different and unique to that company? And it is the culture. It is the way you treat your people. It is how you reward them for their hard work, and not just monetary reward. It's actual acknowledgement and valuing them and rewarding them, that something money can't do.
Yeah,
money makes things convenient, but it doesn't keep you warm and happy at night.
Exactly.
The human interaction, the human relationships. And when you create those genuine relationships inside your organizations, I think that's another level that it kind of hits closer to home. It really starts coming down to your personal values and what you really value. And everything that's happened over the last 2 years with the pandemic and people rethinking their purpose and professional lives and what that looked like before the pandemic, what it's looking like during, and having the isolation and really having a lot of time to reflect and introspect and spend time with the people you love and understand that my time away from home, this is my cost. Yes. There's always a cost. This is the cost of that opportunity to go work and get hired. I lose time and memories that I won't experience or gain back. So when I think about that, it's very fundamental and everybody has it. So when you bring that into your organizations and corporations and small to medium sized companies really start to understand that dynamic, that they do serve a purpose in that space, and they start making their practice and their policies and reward systems, and they model the behavior, because you can't just talk about this. It really has to happen in practice, and it can't be talking about it in theory. And people understand genuine intent. So when you start doing that, I think some of these manufacturing companies that it is repetitive, they start to look different from the culture. And like you said, with the fast food workers, seasonal workers that come back and you just jump right in. And seasonal is when you have that increase drastically happen very quickly. If you have to constantly train, you're disrupting your normal operations, and they're disrupting the operations while you can't even meet the demand. So you're juggling a lot of things in this high stress environment. I think that's where the toxicity starts to come in too, when the pressure and the demand and the stress of delivering makes you forget that when you go on the floor, when you interact with that person, you're not telling them, hey, you need to give me money. You need to put money in the company's pocket. You're telling them that I understand that right now it's high pressure. There's a lot happening. You're stressed out and you're managing your team and you're happy making them feel comfortable too. And we value that as an organization, but we also need to make sure that we're hitting our numbers. And how can us, I, or we as leaders, what are the roadblocks that exist for you that are not allowing you to execute? What's limiting your efficiencies? And if I go back to process improvement, I think having those conversations to really understand what's happening out on the floor of your organization or on the manufacturing floor, and taking the time to walk around. Because in my experience, some upper management executives, they like to criticize from afar. Versus let's go into the floor. I don't remember the show off the top of my head, but where the CEO goes into his company and he actually takes random jobs in the organization to see what the state of the organization is, they almost always come out saying, I didn't know that.
Undercover
boss. People have stories. There you go, undercover boss. And I think that's a great representation of what happens at companies. They grow, that gap widens between who started, the founders, and the realities that happen here. And there is a reality that's happening at the top, but down here, they're not concerned with that because that's not their responsibility, but they should have an understanding of those conversations, really get to understand what the thinking is at a strategic level, where it can seem abstract from that day-to-day implementation, and vice versa. If you're not seeing the problems that exist at the floor, you're not identifying the inefficiencies that may seem little, like you said, but once you look at the P&L statement and you see these big holes, you start to question, well, what happened there? But if those conversations aren't happening, then how are you really aware of that? And how can you fix that and support your...
Oh man. Lose them? You there?
Nope. I just came back in. I'm not sure if that was my side.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so that was so good. Can you hear me? You hear me fine?
I can hear you fine. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Perfect. So, oh man, that was so good. What have you seen? Because you brought up the point about, and I was just talking, I had a conversation with somebody earlier about being intentional during the pandemic and being creative to create that engagement, right? Because you value your employees, because you want to make them feel valued, and you don't have the ability to just walk to their cubicle or go down on the floor. What have you seen? Have you seen any examples, or can you talk to about any examples of that level of intentionality, that level of creativity during the pandemic that has really been helpful in terms of building culture and cultivating that culture? I hope you like what you're hearing so far. The Innovativeness Imperative podcast is made possible by Anchor, which makes it easy for podcasters like me to record, edit, and publish shows in one place. Go to anchor.fm to learn more and set up a free account. Now back to the show.
I think one of the best ones I saw, and just reading in the news, I don't recall what company it was, but technology company, after they onboarded, the owner's handwritten note, personal care basket delivered to the home of the employee that just got onboarded.
Nice, nice.
And it's those little things that mean so much to an employee.
Yeah.
Those really speak to the values that that employee connected with originally, the emotional feeling they had when they went to interview for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the best part of it, it's coming from the top.
Yeah.
It shows that that leader, that executive, that CEO or C-suite individual, they care about their people and their organization, and they want to make sure that there's a safe environment.
Mm-hmm.
So creativity could flow and transparent and honest conversations can happen. But they understand that if they don't build that trust from day one with that employee,
mm-hmm.
there is a social contract that gets broken. In your mind, when you're going to apply at a company and you're having a conversation, you're also processing a lot of things in your head that aren't being said, but mm-hmm. you're implying that if they're telling you you're going to love working here, we value our employees, you're running through scenarios. You're fantasizing in a sense of what it's going to be like when you open those doors and you're wearing that badge. You're going to feel proud. You're going to feel part of that organization. And you're going to say, they understand me, they respect me, and they value me.
Yeah.
But if that's not being practiced by the people you're going to interact with, the teams you'll eventually be on, seeing executives treating each other in ways that don't align with those values, you're going to overlook it for a time. But at some point, that toxicity will poison the well, and it will flow through an organization. And how many months have gone over the last year that you don't see a new scandal with these big, giant, multi-billion dollar corporations or even smaller organizations?
Mm-hmm.
You hear horror stories,
mm-hmm.
and they're not public because they're happening behind closed doors. But once they're public, it's amazing that they get to that size with such toxicity. But financials have a strong influence and power of pushing forward and silencing people.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think about Uber and their CEOs. It went on for a long time, but they were growing exponentially. Like they were growing, they disrupted the whole car share market. Like they basically created that. And so you're right. It kind of went under the rug. People were like, you know, we're getting paid well, we're financially set, but it came to a point, it came to a head where people just couldn't take it anymore. And it's unfortunate, but you know, so that brings me to my next question and last question, actually. What's next? What do you see next in terms of for you, 2022, Ethos Consulting, and then within the whole process improvement consultancy workflow, do you see any trends that you're comfortable talking about?
Me personally, what I would like to do to implement as a trend, and it's something that we're still talking about culture, and that's really come to the forefront, but culture has always existed at companies. And I am seeing a lot more conversations around empathy in culture and empathy in operational practice as well. And we're not talking about empathy in the sense that I need hugs all the time. We're not talking about that, but we are talking about that there is a blend of emotional connection that needs to exist at a company. But there's also the cognitive aspect of empathy, really being able to see other people's perspectives.
Yeah.
Whether that's team members, bosses, executives, but equally employees and customers. When you really start to take different perspectives, it really starts to challenge your strategy. Am I meeting everything that's required of me? Am I taking the time to put myself in the other person's shoes to understand what that experience looks like for them?
Yeah.
And also use that to identify gaps that exist in your process, in your product or your service. So for me, I think that is going to be an ongoing trend this year. And hopefully we'll start to see culture really start getting tied to financial execution.
Mm.
I really want to see a behavioral-based assessment tool that really can measure empathy, that can measure emotional intelligence. And it really starts to connect into the financials, because it's hard taking the soft skills and the hard skills and bridging that gap and talk about it with numbers. Some of it is intangible. How do you quantify an emotion, a feeling?
Yeah.
But you can measure states of mind, and you can measure those people's effectiveness. You can give them training to increase their execution and use of those type of tools that are behavioral based.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can start to see an improvement of effectiveness of output, profitability of one unit versus another one that may have not received that very laser focused training to build up the soft side of the skills. And I think it's going to get bigger as we move forward, because being able to talk and connect with people, it really lets you have a different level of conversation, and it lets you get down to what I want to say as the truth of a conversation. If I don't trust you, whether at work or on my team, why am I going to share with you? And that creates a whole different problem as well. That creates siloed operations, and siloed operations are not good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's excellent. And, you know, it just makes me think, what if we could tie an individual or team's productivity to the innovations that they produce? Tying, as I talked about at the beginning, innovativeness is tied to enhancements in customer experience and employee experience. So if this leader has created an environment within his team where there's accountability, there's candor, there's free-flowing communication or omni-channel communication, and they're being super productive or creating new innovations, that seems like a way, at least a start of a way, to measure empathy, to measure those emotions, those soft skills. But I think that's a tremendous idea. Have you seen it in any organization, or is that something that you're trying to kind of push in your business and as you traverse?
I haven't seen an organization, but I know those tools and those assessments are out there that are very focused on EI, have a lot of science and study and real life data, peer reviewed data that does support that theory and the practice of that theory. And they're able to connect how it really kind of opens up the mind to a different level of creativeness and solution and problem solving as well. And I think it just creates a much more rich organic conversation versus very structured conversation. If you're guarded and reserved, the information isn't flowing like you just mentioned. And when you don't have that information flowing, someone's making a decision with half the information. And that could be key to them implementing something that could really impact the company's performance. So and like working with cross-functional teams, they're bringing those cross-functional teams together. Each of those people walks away with a greater understanding of how their values tie in with someone else's value. And I always think it's key to make the distinction that the metrics of a team are different from the metrics of the organization. And understanding how that team needs to perform as a team, or that individual needs to perform individually, but being able to connect that into the organizational goals and metrics, I think that it really is a key and vital aspect of really understanding what your purpose is at the company, how you're serving that purpose as an individual, and how you're contributing to the company's success while you're also contributing to your own success as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. And man, that would be a great, you know, study, because I'm just thinking, you know, the information is out there. The data is out there. The companies with the most engaged employees, they perform better. The companies with the most engaged employees, they're more innovative, right? And so there has to be, and you got me thinking now, there has to be somebody who did the study already. It just has to be out there, right? Where they've used metrics to tie either the innovativeness, maybe not innovativeness, but the productivity of new innovations, new ideas, to the culture that's in the organization, whether it be, you know, like I said, trust, candor, accountability, communication. They're somebody has to do it. We can't be the only ones thinking like that, right? We can't be the only ones. So I'm gonna do a little bit of research, because you definitely got me thinking. I hope businesses turn the corner on that. Given that everything that's gone on within the last 2 years, the socioeconomic issues, the social injustice issues, the pandemic, everything, economic collapses and just turmoil. You would think that business leaders would be, okay, we got to do things differently now, right? We can't just, you know, everybody. I was watching a webinar with Seth Godin, and what did he say? He said, business leaders are, what did he say? They have nostalgia for the past, right? They you know what I mean? Like they want. We're going in the future, we're moving in the future, but they're homesick for the way things were. Things are fundamentally changing in how we do business and how we relate to each other, but people want to go back to that. And it just goes back to the point you made, the path of least resistance, right? People are more comfortable mm-hmm. with the way things were than the way things are going to be. It's that level of uncertainty, which I love. I personally love uncertainty because I know there's going to be something phenomenal that comes out of it, but most people don't. Most people don't like uncertainty. Most people are absolutely comfortable in doing things the way they've done it for however number of years. And so I hope that trend that you, I'm going to give you credit for when that trend becomes, you know, like something like a best practice where all businesses, all business leaders are creating environments where they're candid with their employees and the employees have that same level of candor, trust, and accountability with their leaders.
Yeah, and I really hope that feature comes quick. And you're right that I like to look to the past, and it's fine. You know, you have to study what's happened in the past to kind of understand the evolution of a company and how it presents itself today. But you can't revert back to that past and try to force that into today's reality because it keeps you in the past. You will go out of business if you're not adapting. And really about the resiliency now of uncertainty. And more globalization, more technology, automation is starting to come in, AI is starting to come in. It's really thinking about what starts to happen if there's a drain on the intelligence that exists in the workforce.
What
are we going to be creating at these companies when we're not showing or putting practices in the business that get us comfortable with the constant flow of uncertainty, but giving them tools to be adaptable, be flexible, not be rigid. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of a company. It's you can't get married to your idea. The ideas have to exist, but you also have to accept that those ideas need to evolve and change with new information, with new environmental changes. And that means your culture as well. You're always going to carry that base level of foundational values that speaks to everybody. But the way that culture puts that into practice, it's going to be evolving. It's going to be changed. We age and we leave the workforce. We're not constant. So when you have the new people coming in, you have to understand their experience, their upbringing, what work looks like for them today. And now as these technologies continue to advance, they look different, but you still do need that legacy, the legacy people in the company to kind of invite them in and learn from each other. Because if you don't have that, you have a constant culture clash that are going to exist at the company and there's never going to be an acceptance of each other. And that creates subversion within how you're operating as well.
No, that's so true. And thanks for joining us this week on the Innovativeness Imperative. We hope that this conversation was helpful and at a minimum gave you a perspective that may be useful in your business. If you like what you heard and want to comment, you can leave a message for us at anchor.fm/Malcolm-Tyson-PhD-I2/message. We're listening and we'll respond to questions during an upcoming show. So record your message and send it in to join in on the innovativeness conversation. You can also subscribe to the show directly on Anchor, iTunes, Spotify, or via RSS feed so you'll never miss a show. Give us a rating and share us with your friends. I'll leave you with a quote by Steve Jobs. You can't just ask customers what they want and then try to give that to them. By the time you get it built, they'll want something new. Thanks again, and until next time, keep innovating and thriving. You made me just think of another thing you don't have to answer this, but I want you to think about it because I just thought about it. With the implementation of AI, machine learning, and RPA, robotic process automation, how does that affect what we're talking about, right? How does that, because you're not eliminating the human factor, you're just shifting it to automation. Like, you know what I mean? Like, how would that play into developing that culture? Because Yeah, it's just something I thought about, and I think we can go into another lane with that, but it's just something I just thought about. And you know, how does, you know, replacing the humans that were doing these, you know, repetitive activities, and I wonder how that will play out in a manufacturing environment, right? Where you have these repetitive tasks that now you're programming robots to do. How do you create a culture, right, that accepts that and is still just as or even more productive than when you implemented these robots? So in, anyway, something to think about, and I'll bring you on to another show and we can talk about that a little bit.
The robot overlords that will take over one day, right? Yeah,
exactly. But so I really appreciate this has been enlightening for me and just fun. I really appreciate you taking the time, Humberto.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on and taking the time with me as well. Enjoy the conversation. And yeah, there's an endless possibilities you could talk about with this subject. And that's what's the exciting part of it. And I think that's kind of speaks to innovation as well. There's the constant adapting and changing and new thoughts that happen with it. It doesn't stay stale.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, you enjoy the rest of your evening. Make sure you spend time with your girls over the weekend, and we will definitely be in touch. Thank you.
Sounds good. Take care.
All right, buddy.
Have a good one. Enjoy your weekend. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Yay! Oh, thank you.